It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Cutie Pock Talk.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Cutie Pock Talk, where we invite you to sit down and listen to what's happening in our queer and trans community out here in Portland. I'm Darian Jones, here with
Oscar Guerra, hey Portland,
and Phoenix Singer, hello,
and our special guest tonight, Gregory McKelvey from Portland's Resistance.
Hey, Greg.
Hi, it's nice to be with you guys.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here, Greg. So we're going to start tonight out reading a few different kind of quotes from history to kind of set the tone for tonight's episode.
Okay. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none. Has none. This was said by Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael, a civil rights activist and leading member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party.
But it's not enough for me to stand here for you tonight and condemn riots. It would be morally irresponsible for me to do that without, at this time, condemning and contingent, intolerable conditions that exist in our society. These conditions are the things that cause individuals to feel that they have no other alternative to engage in violent rebellions to get attention. And I must say tonight that a riot is the language of the unheard, and it is what America has failed to hear. It has failed to hear the promises of freedom and justice that have not been met. And it has failed to hear the large segments of white society that are so concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice or humanity. Martin Luther King, The Other America, 1961.
68.
And also, I wish I were a bank so white people would care about me and fundraise for my reparations as well. Anonymous quote.
Wow. Well, those are some powerful, powerful statements to kind of set the tone, I think, for tonight's episode, you know, which is following a really, really surprising turn of events here, I think, in our nation, especially here in Oregon, you know. So tonight's episode, as you all know, is about the election results, kind of what happens next in Oregon and preparing Portland for what has been known as Donald Trump's America. So I guess reflecting on those quotes, you know, what are your thoughts on those, Phoenix? Phoenix, how do you feel about what you had to read there?
Well, so Kwame Ture is saying that in a context of the 1960s, during a moment in which the Black Panther Party is rising pretty quickly around the time of Martin Luther King's assassination, proving that nonviolence was not enough. That ultimately, that even if you were to refuse to be complicit through nonviolent means, that they will kill you. And Martin Luther King knew this. That's why many of his protests, he and other people that joined him were willing to be attacked by the Klan, by the cops, by vigilantes, to show America that even when nonviolent, this country cannot abide by resistance.
Thank you for that context and for bringing that up. Reading the anonymous quote for our friend, especially like banks, institutions, getting bailouts and finding having this trajectory and this sequence of patterns of these systems that keep linear thinking, that keep things the same and ultimately fund, as this quote was saying, I wish I were a white person so I can get my reparations paid for. Or I was a bank so my reparations can also be paid for.
Same thing.
Right. Yes. Very, very interchangeably. Yeah.
How did you feel about those quotes, Greg?
I've been saying that Martin Luther King quote like all the time recently. I think it's really important because I think that a lot of people in our community, when the police declared that a riot was going on or whatever, did like a ton of just first level analysis and saying, oh, I don't like violence, I don't like destruction. But nobody's thinking about why, and nobody's thinking about why those people are feeling unheard, and nobody's really talking about how we can channel that anger and frustration and disillusion into something positive for our community.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's a really good kind of thought to kind of segue into, you know, a big portion of the show today, which is kind of interviewing you and kind of trying to get a little bit more clarity brought to the conversation that's really being had in Portland right now with the, you know, the protests and what do turn into riots and kind of a lot of things that people have been seeing through the media. You know, I know someone that's been fortunate enough where I've been able to stream the reality that a lot of people are kind of experiencing downtown, and it's really scary and pretty daunting, actually. And so honestly, I guess to kind of start this interview off, Greg, let's get people familiar with you. Like, who are you? Like, who is Greg McKelvey? Like, what kind of launched you into this role that you have now, which we'll kind of get into a little bit later.
Sure. So, I'm Greg McKelvey. I am 23 years old. I'm a law student at Lewis and Clark in my last year of law school. I graduated from Oregon State with degrees in political science and history. Mm. And ever since then, I've been working in politics, running political campaigns, and as a political advisor. And then that led me to also jump into activism. So I worked closely with Don't Shoot Portland for a long time. And because of that and my connections to that movement, I was able to work on the Bernie Sanders campaign. Oh. And that's basically where I started, like, doing public speaking and such. And so I did a lot of speeches just for rallies and stuff for the Bernie Sanders campaign. And that's what kind of like thrusted me into the limelight. I was also elected as a delegate to the national convention. And so I've just been doing politics, activism, law school, and, you know, running campaigns. And, you know, then recently this happened. And so we started Portland's Resistance.
Yeah, so you keep creating these great segues to all the questions. It's amazing. So when you say you kind of created Portland's Resistance, what inspired that? And to be really more specific, one of the questions that I had given to me later today from a community member is, you know, what exactly do you think we're resisting to?
The start of Portland's Resistance was basically we thought that people were going to be in the streets no matter what, and we did see that on election day before Portland's Resistance even existed. So because I've had a lot of experience protesting, marching through the streets, mm-hmm. I know how our police force works and deals with peaceful protests. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people are brand new to being in the streets and marching, and they wanted a centralized location of where these going to start. And also I wanted to make sure that people understood like the legal support number of who to call, if you get arrested, that they would have support, and also like how to do routes throughout. There's all sorts of intricacies into having a successful march. So I just wanted to like, help use the experience that I've had to do that. And what I envisioned it as at first was just for like these first few days so that we would have a centralized location and so that myself and a lot of others that have been involved in protests could kind of help guide so people know, you know, the legal support and how to stay safe out there. And then like it just took off on Facebook. And so like we've been in 24/7 just organizing mode ever since then so that we can harness this energy into something positive for our community.
That sounds amazing. I mean, what I hear from that is that you were seeking this opportunity to empower your community into being aware of how to do things successfully and to also know, as you mentioned, like the best way to manage and facilitate a space for resistance.
Yeah, and you know, it wasn't my job, and I still don't think it's my job to censor anybody else's activism. Mm. And so I'm for all power to the people. So, I mean, there are marches and protests that have happened without Portland's resistance since Donald Trump was elected. But I just want to use the organizational capacity that I've learned and the experience that I've had to just kind of lend that to the people that might be new to doing this to just support in any way that I can.
I think that's really good. That's really powerful. And, you know, standing behind, I think everyone right now is kind of what we need as a community. And then really, I think something that I really want to clarify for people is kind of what's the difference from a peaceful protest? Or like, what do you view as this peaceful protest? Or what does it mean to you?
You know, I think there's like a problem in just differentiating here, like between good activists and bad activists. I think there has to be a diversity of tactics. But at the same time, a lot of the people that are coming out just for personal safety want to be involved in something peaceful. But I don't think, you know, it's our job to talk down on people that are out there that feel unheard, as Martin Luther King said. But a lot of people do want to come out there and see something peaceful. In my group specifically, thinks that in order to build our standing in the community so that we can reach our goals, which are actual policy goals, that to do that, we need to have a face of peacefulness and unity and somewhere that everybody can feel comfortable to express themselves and use their First Amendment right to push for progress. Because I really think that's the most patriotic thing that anybody can do. You know, our nation was founded in protests, and I bet there were people that were yelling at the people throwing tea out in the Boston Harbor, like, what about that property? Or, you know, you're messing up the harbor. Well, we need traffic to go through there today.
That's violent. You know,
that's violent or something like that. And I think, like, looking back on history, the people that have protested, I mean, whether it was the anti-war movement or civil rights or our nation being founded or women's suffrage or... you know, even the liberation of LGBTQ people, like all of that. If you look back in history, when they were protesting, there were people trying to stick to the status quo. And it's always the people that were protesting that end up on the right side of history. And so I don't understand why all these politicians or the cops or anybody just consistently are standing on the wrong side of history. Because what do we want to look like in 20, 50 years, 100 years when people look back and they say Donald Trump was elected? Do we want to be the people that were just complicit and okay with that? Or do we want to be the people that stood up as one America and said, no, this is not okay?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good kind of question when you think about the message that we want to send to the nation from Portland. And, you know, this movement's gotten a lot of coverage. I mean, just again, back to those Facebook videos, there's 4,000 views in one night from, you know, one person here. And there's been reports on national channels about, you know, what's going on here in Portland. And so I guess, you know, one of my questions is, what do you think the message that is kind of up to Portland to send to the rest of the nation in response to President-elect Donald Trump?
I think that we have to, one, understand that he is going to be president. You know, a lot of people are spending a lot of energy in trying to stop that, you know, talking about the Electoral College and such. And I think that last Tuesday was the time to do that. To try and stop Donald Trump from being president. The way I look at it is, like, if somebody has a loaded gun to your head, do you, like, look in the barrel and, like, say, can we, like, find a way to get that bullet out of there? Or do you run, right? And we gotta run. And, you know, Donald Trump is talking about eliminating the EPA and, you know, taking away Obamacare. And people say, give him a chance. I don't think our earth has the opportunity to say, give him a chance. You know, I don't have the opportunity to say, give him a chance and see if I'm going to be taken off Obamacare, you know, and people don't have a chance. I don't have a chance to say, you know, let's wait and see if he's going to deport a bunch of my friends. You know, that's, we can't do that. So what we have to do is build Portland to step up. You know, a lot of the things on climate change and such, if the EPA is eliminated, has to be done now at the state level. Healthcare has to be done now at the state level. And we have a lot of things locally with racial disparity, not just in society, but in policing and, you know, the housing crisis here. And these are things that many people thought we might have an ally in the White House, and we don't now. So we need to make sure that we build our communities up so that we can insulate ourselves from a Donald Trump presidency.
Wow, I think that's definitely, it's kind of the outlines for a really good sort of, I don't want to say battle plan, but definitely a really good plan and response for Portland. And, you know, I definitely want to get a little bit deeper insights as to what maybe some of those initiatives might look like for Portland's resistance and the community here in the upcoming year, because, you know, it's always time to get some measures out. But before we do that, we're actually going to have to send you all off into our first commercial break here in 3. back to Cutie Pock Talk.
Hey, Portland. What's up?
Hello.
I'm back with our special guest here, Gregory McKelvey from Portland's Resistance. So, Greg, when we left off with our listeners here, we kind of were just about to dive into the conversation about, you know, what the upcoming year really looks like for Portland to, you know, kind of, in a sense, mobilize people to respond to this kind of surprise that we have at our feet. So let's kind of jump in it. Like, what have you all kind of started working on an agenda for the upcoming session? Do you have a coalition that you have begun kind of engaging?
So because I've been involved a lot, like, here we have, like, people that are involved in our organization that have been working on a lot of these things already. And I know a lot of the people that have been working on these things already, but we haven't specifically as a group started building, like, a large coalition, but we do have an idea of the policies that we want to push, such as, like, at the state level, ending the ban on rent control. And I also think that there's a little controversy and it needs to be worked out on the courts, whether there really is a ban on rent control, because the statute itself states that they can enact rent control if there's a natural or man-made disaster. And I would argue that our housing crisis right now is a man-made disaster. They want to portray it as just that, like, if somebody lights your community on fire or something like that. But if you get kicked out of your home, what's the difference than if your home was on fire? I would argue that this is a man-made disaster done by, you know, the corporate elite and the political elite and the establishment, and they're to blame, and thus we should be at the city level to enact rent control. But it would be easier if we lift the preemption at the state level. Also, I think we need to go farther on climate change. Coal to clean was a nice step, but it still allows us to be relying on natural gas. Which I would rather us find, like, another word for natural gas, because natural gas sounds good, but it's not. It's a fossil fuel. And for everybody that's standing up against the pipeline being built right now, like, that's carrying natural gas. So, but our current coal to clean transitions us off of, like, coal and puts us, you know, still allows us to use natural gas, which is still a fossil fuel. And I think we need to end the fossil fuel industry completely. And we shouldn't have any fossil fuel infrastructure in our community for sure. I also think that we need to, like, talk and address the racial disparity in society in Oregon and the racist past that we have. Oregon was founded as a white utopia, and, and that's one of the reasons why we see so few black people here. And it wasn't made for people that look like me. And so we need to make it more accommodable, like, just better for us. And instead of just being, like, a white progressive liberal city, we need to be welcoming for all people. Right now in Portland, 64% of the people that are designated to be basically under different form of surveillance that the Gang Enforcement Task Force deals with are black, when only around 6% of our city is black. And a majority, and that's just black. So if we add other people of color, it's way even more. And a majority of the people that are put on there are put on there for the clothing or the jewelry that they wear, which is racist.
Whoa.
Right. It's racist.
Wow.
So
okay.
So if you break it down into sections of the people that are put designated for the Gang Enforcement Task Force, the smallest section is people that are self-identified gang members. So it's basically it's basically the police singling people out based on their family history or what
profiling.
They wear and dress like. They're profiling.
Sounds like it got ended with HB 2002 or it's created ridiculous. A way to report it, maybe.
And it shouldn't be constitutional because we have an equal protection clause in the Constitution. And so it doesn't make sense that that's allowed to occur. But so those are some of the main things, I think: climate change, racial disparity in policing and in society, and also our housing crisis.
That's a lot. That's a lot to kind of put on your plate all at once, you know. But I definitely think those are all needs that.
I hear that, and that you're also talking about, you know, things that are going on at the local Portland level, and then being that we have a state legislative session beginning in January, are there any specific policies or bills that you all also support in the area. Darian just mentioned HB 2002, which is the end profiling law of the state of Oregon.
I think we need that. And it's not just about like baking cakes. It's about like if an ambulance is coming, you know, like for example, when we got beat out of City Hall when we were trying to testify against the police contract, the ambulance wouldn't come up because they said it was too dangerous. We were profiled. And so this isn't just about cakes and popsicles. This is life or death. And so especially in a Donald Trump presidency, I also think we need single payer health care at the state level, especially if Obamacare is going to be going away.
Yeah.
I think that's crucial. We need a health care for all system. And I think that health care should be considered a human right.
And so kind of, you know, just I guess really just staying on the narrative of this racial disparity. And one of the questions I had was sort of, you know, what do you think led to Donald Trump's winning of the Electoral College? And, you know, I think a lot of the things that people equate to it, it seems to me, at least from the media, is, you know, this notion of there's a really weird kind of notion that he won because of the fact that, you know, the blacks, like, essentially what they say is the blacks didn't vote. And that,
which is not true.
No, it's not, but I'm just curious to know your kind of insights, because I think there's a lot more that goes into when we talk about racial disparities is the access to for people to actually be able to volunteer or to vote. I mean, is there actually a poll that they can get access to? Do they have transportation? And do they even know that they can vote? Because a lot of people, you know, they end up in jail and they come out and they think that they can't actually vote. And so I think our society has a really good way of kind of compounding racism in different threads. And so I just want to know what your insights on the kind of things that you could say equated to this.
So I don't think that it's at all a coincidence that we went from our first black president to a president that basically ran on racial undertones and rhetoric. I don't think that's a coincidence at all. I don't think it's a coincidence also that after the Supreme Court gets rid of the Voting Rights Act and all these poll stations close, that we end up with one of the most racist presidents. I mean, I can't say he's the most racist because we had like 13 presidents that were slaveholders. But in my lifetime, which isn't that long, but in the history that I've studied, you know, we haven't seen a campaign like this where he launched his campaign on racism. You know, this is a guy that was sued twice by the Justice Department for not renting to black people. When the New York Five was wrongfully imprisoned for raping a woman that they did not do that to, he called for their execution so that and called them thugs, and they were innocent. You know, this isn't new. Racism isn't new to him, and that's why I don't get the let's give him a chance. Maybe he just campaigned on this. No, he didn't just campaign on this. Like, this is how he's lived. This is what he's about. But when it comes to the Electoral College, it was designed to make sure that cities didn't have more power over rural communities. And I think that these people that vote for Donald Trump, they're like, they feel like their America is slipping away, you know, make America great again. And they want it back. And I'm hoping this is their last dying breath and there's not too much damage in it. But there probably will be. But I really think, you know, they're scared. They saw a first black president and then a woman running. And they see all this stuff about gay rights and civil rights and things like that. But it doesn't matter to them. They're like, when is the white man gonna get a break in America, right?
Right. And Phoenix, I think you've got something.
Yeah. So I just want to point out the statistics of who voted. Majority of white men and women age 18 to 29 voted for Trump. So this is clearly something that's fully part of our generation. I also just wanted to point out on that same note, Colin Kaepernick, who recently got in trouble for kneeling. Refusing to make a stand for the national anthem. He recently described why he didn't vote. You know, I think it would be hypocritical of me to vote. I said from the beginning I was against oppression. I was against the system of oppression. I'm not going to show support for that system. And to me, the oppressor isn't going to allow you to vote your way out of your oppression. So my question is electoral politics really the be-all, end-all? Because this country was built literally to support slavery. The founding fathers were threatened by England with abolition, and so they revolted. This is something that a lot of historical scholars have said. So is electoral politics our way to liberation? It seems like this very country is built on genocide and enslavement. And this was really a revolt in favor of it.
Possibly, but I think, one, I've traveled all around the world, and I really do love America. And I think that we are the only country in the world that has revolution built into our constitution. You know, and we almost saw it this year with Bernie Sanders. And I think that there's nothing more American than pushing for progress, because America has a horrible, dark past. But we do progress.
And present.
And present, yeah. But we do progress, and we have the ability to progress. And maybe it's not going fast enough, but and a lot of people are still suffering. But I think that there's definitely a false equivalency. I saw, and I'm no Hillary Clinton fan whatsoever, and I think that she is probably the reason that we have a Donald Trump presidency. I think if, you know, the DNC didn't conspire against Bernie Sanders, we'd probably be looking at a Bernie Sanders presidency right now. But we can't not think about the Supreme Court. So if Donald Trump gets 4 nominees to the Supreme Court, that does huge damage to any sort of progress that America can make. I saw, and I supported Colin Kaepernick and what he was doing, but I saw a quote from him like that said, it's almost like they're competing about who's less or more racist. And that's just a false equivalency. Like, there's no question who's more racist there. But I do think that Hillary Clinton has been a part of perpetuating systems that are discriminating against people of color, whether that was perpetuating the war on drugs, whether it was the super predators comment, whether it's just been her corporate ties. But at the same time, I look at this I think the presidency is not as powerful as people think. It's Congress and the Supreme Court that are the most powerful. And we have a very scary Republican Congress. And I think Donald Trump will sign anything that comes to his desk from that Congress, and will put people on the Supreme Court that are going to, you know, not allow us to make common sense gun legislation, that are going to take back the discrimination laws that we've been able to build, and that could possibly reverse Roe v. Wade. What kind of damage would that do to our country? And so I agree that we do have to do things outside of the electoral process. But at the same time, I don't think we can ignore the fact that politicians do impact our lives right now, and some are worse than others.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely not going to disagree that politicians impact our lives. I think it would be silly to say that. But I do have a concern about really the convergence of interests that Republicans and Democrats have had, which was the maintenance of the settler colonial system, the continued dispossession of Native peoples, the investment in the prison industrial complex as a modern form of slavery, imperialist warfare, drone warfare. These are all things that the Democrats have agreed with on Republicans.
Corporatism.
And corporatism. So it's, to me, it seems like the Democrats are just the nicer face of racism, whereas the Republicans represent the we have Klan uniforms in our closet. But the thing is, when the Great Migration happened and millions of black people escaped the South to the North, they faced different kinds of like Northern liberal racism, which often presented itself as not racist. That is something that a lot of people, including those who supported Hillary Clinton, when BLM protested Bill Clinton, he said to their face, the reason why I passed the 1994 crime bill is because all of you are violent. Though we really, for me, it seems almost impossible to seek liberation in a system in which both parties support the structures that enslave and colonize us. I don't think we can escape that through voting.
Sure, but it's so easy to vote. So
we only have 3 parties, right?
Well, we have more than that, but we have a pirate party. But it's so easy to vote, especially in Oregon. So I agree with you that voting is not enough, and if we would have, if Hillary Clinton would be president, we would have huge problems still.
But Trump's it's so easy to vote,
and so I don't get why we're spending so much time here today, but in general, as a country, talking about this vote that we just had to fill out a bubble that I think does affect our lives. But we need to put in the work, and that's what the reason for the resistance is in the other 4 years.
So I think, you know, kind of drawing us back into what that vote has done, and really kind of focusing on, you know, this new hierarchy that we're kind of in, where people forget that there is, you know, Donald Trump, but on the side, in the sidelines, reading a book menacingly might be Mike Pence. And, you know...
Can I say some things about Mike Pence?
You know, yeah, I got some really big questions, and I really want to know how you feel about 2 days ago when he was appointed the head of the Donald Trump's transition team, really was replacing Chris Christie.
So Mike Pence said, like, in the past that we shouldn't help fund your health care if you're gay and have AIDS until you go through conversion therapy. That's what we should fund. What the hell? He also said that women that have an abortion should have to pay for the funeral.
Wow. Yeah. Mm. And that is the person who
of the fetus.
Yeah, so I think, you know, people really don't realize the magnitude of this presidency, this presidential election, and the fact that, you know, right now we're kind of looking at a position where we were, let's say, 8-12 years ago when, you know, a president had control of both the House and the Senate. And that's kind of exactly what we have right now. And essentially, it's just... I think the reality is that we need to get together as a group, just like you're saying here, and kind of work on things at the local level here in Portland, and kind of reflect on our community and increasing that. So on that note, we're going to take our next break here in 3, 2.
We are having a technical opportunity right now. You have been listening to Cutie Pock Talk. They're going to come back in just a moment. Give me a minute, and I'll try to make more noise come out of this machine. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Settle back, easy.
another pretty face. You may be the fate of a feeling, sleeping and perchance a dream. Honest to the point of recklessness, self-centered.
Getting really into the Grateful Dead, he looks like tonight, y'all.
Get it, Darian.
Yeah, just, you know, when I just get to it sometimes. So I'd like to welcome you all back here to Cutie Pog Talk with Darian Jones.
Welcome all. Oscar here.
Phoenix Singers, writing, texting. And we've got Greg McKelvey from Portland's
what
Resistance.
Up? What's up, Greg?
So, you know, Greg, when we left off, we were kind of getting out of the state level, and we kind of want to bring it back into sort of... at a similar national level, but really, really the media that's kind of you all have gotten at Portland's Resistance, and really trying to understand like what here is true in the narrative that we've kind of seen out there. And I know I'm someone that's definitely seen your Facebook page. I've seen a few of the posts, videos, and this GoFundMe page that you all started, which what I believe to look like a really great project to kind of, you know, help Portland's community thrive after some things that happened last week. But we've been getting a few messages here from some of our listeners who feel really some type of way about that project, and they really want to know direct. This is a direct question, so you know, it's a why is private property more important than Black lives? Chase Bank doesn't need no money.
Yeah, I don't know where anybody came up with the idea that any dollar would ever come from us to Chase Bank or any major corporation or corporation whatsoever. I don't know where that came from. I also, if anybody knows me, I'm like one of the leaders in Black Lives Matter type stuff over here doing that kind of stuff. So obviously I think that matters more. I'm also like a self-avowed socialist. So to say like that I care more about private property than Black lives. I mean, I think anybody that personally knows me knows that's not true. So I think a lot of people are also upset hearing that kind of stuff. But I don't know if they're, I mean, I'm not able to keep up with the news that's going on. I don't know if the news reported that, but I know for a fact it didn't come from me or my group. So I don't know if that's rumors, the media or what, but that is not true. That money, for one, we've obviously raised more money than the claims that have come in, especially because of insurance of what's going on. It's only for, it was supposed to only be made for small and local businesses, meaning ones that are literally local to be that, and it's for the workers so that the workers can continue their work, because as a socialist and somebody that really supports the union movement, that's what I'm about, the workers, not the corporations. But that said, we've also raised more money, and I think that the fund was to rebuild Portland, and I think the way to rebuild Portland, especially with this extra money, is to fund and help fund the groups that are working on the types of things that are working on our platform. So that's where that money is going to end up going, and no money is going to any corporation or major corporation whatsoever. It's for the workers. It's for the certain individuals, like the single moms that came back to their cars and had their windows popped out, right. and they had babies seats in the car, and now they have to figure out what they're going to do to keep their kids safe when they're driving, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what that money is for, to rebuild Portland. But I also, we didn't expect to raise $100. It was more to just say that this was not us, and we want to make sure that it wasn't us, and the damages that are done, we're still going to take responsibility for. But that said, that money is going to be invested right back into our community. Not $1 is going to go to a corporation. It's going to go to groups like, you know, I don't want to name groups because I don't know if they're going to accept the money. But it's going to go to the groups that are working towards the types of things that our platform is working towards. And the fund says it's to rebuild Portland. That's what Portland's resistance is all about. And that's what these groups are all about. So I promise you, Chase Bank is not getting a dollar. And I promise you, Black Lives Matter movements are getting a lot more.
Some of these rumors that come with the territory of getting more media attention, I suppose, and certainly Portland Resistance has been receiving a lot more attention in media. Thank you for elaborating on what messages are true and which ones are not. Is Portland's Resistance, people, you know, we've heard other things like Portland's Resistance is the cause of the riots that have been going on. And what is, you know, Portland Resistance doing to help? And so what would you say to like address some of those things that have been coming up and...
For one, we are providing legal support for people that are arrested not at our rallies. Not one person has ever been arrested at any of our rallies or protests. And I also want to make it clear that there were going to be people in the streets no matter what. And we're still helping those people. But when it comes to people... saying we're, I get it from both sides, right? Mm-hmm. I get the radicals that are like, why are you funding Chase Bank when I'm not? And then I get like the just neoliberals that are like, why are you inciting riots when I'm not? But it's not my job to censor anybody's activism. All I can do is lead by example. And what I'm going to do is set a peaceful example, but I'm not going to yell at you. I'd rather for doing whatever, for smashing Chase Bank's windows, I'd rather yell at Chase Bank for ruining our community.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really... really powerful statement.
That said, it's not us doing the riots, but the, you know, the reason is because there's no riots. We have 4,000 people in the streets.
There was a white riot I saw on the news.
If you a white riot. If you have,
wasn't just white folks.
If you have there's, you know, there, and I'm also, I need to address this. I am so upset with the police and the media in saying that it's the anarchists doing this, because you cannot blame a legitimate political ideology for the group of for the actions of certain individuals. I don't care if they're self-describing anarchists or they're not. There's no anarchist groups conspiring to riot, you know? Like, this is a political ideology that, whether you know it or not, a lot of people, especially in our, you know, circles, possibly subscribe to this ideology. Mm-hmm. And like this tactic of division coming from the media and the police, it just really makes me upset. And then the fact that people are buying into that, especially when people know me, I've been out in the streets for 5 years marching all the time. And so to hear this stuff like, oh, good activists versus bad activists, or there was something about we have peaceful protesters telling us who the problem people are. No, you don't. Mm-hmm. You don't have peaceful protesters telling you anything like that, because we're all protesters and we have a diversity of tactics, but we're all after the same goal, and that's to dismantle the status quo and the system as it is and create a new Portland here that I think we all want to see that includes equality for all. But this idea that like it's us versus the anarchists, and that there's never once been anything from Portland's resistance that said it wasn't us, it was the anarchists. Never once. But then I have people on both sides. You know, I have some people saying you incited a riot, and then I have some people saying, hey, why are you blaming our groups for the riot? Mm-hmm. I have never once said that, and no one from our group has, and the page has never said anything like that. So I'm really upset when people say, you know, I don't support the state and I don't support the corporate media, until they say something that I already kind of thought, and now I'm running with that. If you don't support the state and you don't support the corporate media, then why are you going to play into their tactics of division?
Dang, that is, yeah, thank you. That is really what I think people really definitely needed to hear, and I think the clarity. And you know what, I'm not sure if anyone else has a question, but I've got one more really, really good question. And it's about your, what seems to be your friendly relationship with Portland Police and Mayor Charlie Hales.
Is that a joke?
So... it's me making a joke.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was about to be so livid.
Just because, well, there have been some things that, you know, the police are working with the peaceful protesters who, you know, no one really identifies, but it definitely seems like they might not be people of color, and that those groups are the people to, you know, look like they're safe, but maybe these other groups the police are looking out for and they're trying to stop. And so is it true that, you know, since you're leading these peaceful protesters, that the police are working with you? Because what looks identified to me in the media when they say peaceful protesters, it doesn't like any people of color. People of color look like the people the police are chasing.
Yeah, we're scary.
Yeah.
So, especially like when you have a megaphone. Black person with a megaphone, that's scary. Okay. I will never and have never spoken or collaborated or talked to or snitched to or had anything to do with the police. I can't stand the police, and I have a long history of dealing with the Portland police, getting beat by the Portland police, being pepper sprayed by the Portland police, being handcuffed by the Portland police. I don't mess with the police whatsoever. And honestly, I don't think that there is anybody giving them any information. If there was, we would have seen charges other than disorderly conduct. We would have seen people charged with destroying property and vandalism and stuff like that. So I don't think there is not one peaceful protester. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was somebody that had never protested before that was like, hey, I saw some scary stuff. But there's nobody like pointing people out or anything. And like Mike Marshman said something the other day that like, if we want to protest or something, you just call us, we'll give you a permit, we'll even make the route for you. We're protesting you. Why would we want you to make our route when we're protesting you? Why would like, do you think the people that are throwing tea into the Boston Harbor got a permit to throw the tea into the harbor? No, of course not. We can't protest the state and then ask the state to help us do it. Charlie Hales also said that you have to do more than protesting. You have to engage in the political process. Protesting is the political process. There's nothing more patriotic. There's nothing that forces change more than protesting. And it's a huge part of the political process. Not to mention, I did try and get involved in the political process and go to City Hall and testify against the police union contract. And he beat myself, my whole group, men, women, children, disabled, elderly people out of City Hall. So to say, oh, just come in to City Hall, engage in the political process. We tried that and you beat us out. So no, I have no interest in talking to the police. I will not ever sit down with the police, and I have sat down with Charlie Hales before, and I will never do it again because I lost all respect for him after I saw him beat men, women, children, disabled, elderly people out of City Hall.
And so, wow. So when we think about that and this situation with the police and how they're supposed to be, you know, our protectors, our guardians here in Portland. I really am curious to know about, you know, your safety and the safety of kind of all of the organizers that are working for Portland's resistance, because I know at the, you know, the vigil, there was a discussion that's kind of started in the middle about the fact that a lot of the organizers in the group have had their, you know, photos posted on Craigslist with, you know, essentially bounties out for them and their imprisonment and essentially their death. And it's terrible. And I really, you know, want to know what is the best way that we can kind of, you know, make sure that you're safe and, you know, the organizers are safe and the real realities of that, because there is a neo-Nazi movement that's coming up here in Portland.
So I'm under constant death threat, but I have been for some time. Before this happened, it's definitely amped up. I just watched a whole episode on myself on conservative conspiracy show about how I'm a DNC plant funded by George Soros, and I'm like, I wish.
Get that money.
But what's funny is the cops say protect and to serve. We're the ones under constant threat. Yet at a rally or a march, they're sitting pointing towards us. What they should be doing is looking the other way, watching out for these neo-Nazis and these, you know, extremist patriots, watching out for them, because they're the ones that are threatening me all the time. I've never once threatened somebody's life. But at the same time, I don't work with the police, so I've never once told the police, hey, I'm under death threat, because I honestly feel like I'm under the biggest death threat when I'm around the police. With that said, while I am under a constant threat of death and stuff, and it is, you know, I'm not going to lie, it's scary, but I think there's only two ways for this to end for me, and that is in my death or in completely flipping the table in Portland and seeing a political revolution here. So I'm going to keep fighting until one of those two things happens. But what I'm worried about is all these people, and I shame on the Oregonian for publishing all these faces and those names of everybody arrested, including people that were underage. Posting all of that, because now every single one of them is getting death threats, and that's who I worry about, because a lot of these people had never been in the streets before. So we always hear, you can't let the terrorists win. These people are now terrified, and so who knows if they're gonna, what I would say, engage in the political process in protesting, or, as you know, our police call, rioting. But who knows if they're going to do this anymore, because, you know, these people are now threatening them, and we also have to talk about the fact that these threats are real. These are not empty Facebook threats or anything like that. These are unstable people. They're militia members. They open carry, have all sorts of guns all over the place, and this is what they've been waiting for, to be emboldened to do this kind of stuff. I mean, we've seen Trump supporters come out the woodwork that were never saying anything, and then when Trump won, they're like, yep, I'm loading up. And it's the people that were just peacefully protesting that I worry about. And also, nobody's looking into the fact that, one, all those charges were dropped, or, you know, or made into violations. They can bring them back later, but they're not going to, because there's no evidence, because they didn't do anything other than peacefully protest. They're arrested for disorderly conduct or interfering with the peace officer, which is code for, I arrested you for peacefully protesting. And then they're getting threats as if they were the ones doing any sort of destruction to the city, yet not one of them has been charged with doing destruction to the city. So they come to peacefully protest, now they're under constant threat, and those are the people that I worry about the most, not myself. And that's our number one priority for Portland's resistance right now, is not the money, is not, you know, more protests or anything like that. It's the fact that these threats are real, and we need to keep these people safe. And so that's why you've seen less of us into the streets, and less of us talking about funds or anything like that, because the number one thing I'm thinking about right now is making sure that people live through this.
So how can you know, people do that? How can people engage with Portland's resistance? How can we help make these people safe?
If you don't feel safe or you are arrested, please message our page or email us at portlandsresistance@gmail.com. The Facebook page is Portland's Resistance, and we will use all of our capacity possible to make sure that we keep you safe. And that looks like things such as safe houses, you know, getting you out of town if we need to, because, you know, we can't take this lightly. And also, just in general, just building community, which is what Portland's resistance is all about, so that we have ways to keep people safe, because moving forward through 4 years of a Trump presidency, we're all going to be under threat for all marginalized communities. Everybody at this table right now is going to be under threat. And so moving forward, how do we organize to keep people safe? And that looks like phone trees, that looks like securing your social media, that looks like locking your door, and maybe securing it more. And, you know, it's just scary. It's really scary. I've always been like so anti-gun in my whole life. Like, I want guns to not exist. And now I'm like, dang, in this scary world, should I have a gun? And, you know, I don't know what to do, because I've always felt like I was more at risk of hurting myself than I was of actually being at threat by somebody. And now it's like the scales might have tipped, and maybe I'm more at risk of being hurt by somebody. But yeah, we need to build community, and please get at our group if you feel unsafe, because we will stop everything to make sure that people are safe. That's our number one priority. I don't care what we have to do. I will come to your house, because it's not okay, and it's my number one fear that somebody's actually gonna get hurt. And, you know, somebody did get shot. We live in a scary America right now, and Portland's resistance isn't here just to make policy changes or just to protest, but also so we can build community. And you can't do that unless people are safe. And that's my number one priority, and what I work on 24/7 now, ever since these threats have popped up.
We are so lucky to have you and Portland's resistance in the community. Just, you know, people don't take this as, you know, the reality and the urgency isn't placed on it, and the fact that, you know, people's lives are at risk. So, you know, Greg, we all want to thank you so much for joining us here today on the show.
Anytime.
You know, I want everyone out there, if you have the chance, to take a look at Portland's resistance page on Facebook. You can like it, you know.
Follow me at Gregory McKelvey too, or at G McKelvey on Instagram.
That's awesome. So with that, you all, we're going to end tonight's episode of Cutie Pog Talk. Tune in next month.
See ya. See y'all next time.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah,
bye.
It's 7 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.